From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Right now, the grim realities and moral uncertainties of war are very real and very present. U.S. troops on tough patrol, searing images from Abu Ghraib, flag-draped coffins of American soldiers, generals in the hot seat in Washington, and still unanswered questions about why America went to war. As Iraq booms with gunfire, American moviegoers are lining up at the box office to see the new blockbuster, Troy. Even in its high-gloss Hollywood presentation, the adaptation of the ancient Greek epic, The Iliad, cannot help but remind 2004 audiences of just how the ideals and follies of war repeat through the ages. In this scene from Troy, Achilles, played by Brad Pitt, warns King Agamemnon, played by Brian Cox, against a premature celebration of victory.
A great victory was won today, but that victory is not yours. Kings did not kneel to Achilles.
Perhaps the kings were too far behind to see. The soldiers won the battle.
History remembers kings, not soldiers. Tomorrow we'll batter down the gates of Troy. I'll build monuments to victory on every island of Greece. I'll carve Agamemnon in the stone.
Be careful, King of Kings. First, you need the victory.
Tonight on Point, war and human nature in Homer's Iliad and Hollywood's Troy. Have you seen the movie Troy? Have you reread the Iliad, read it for the first time? What's the message on war, its causes, its consequences for the world then and now? What lessons from Troy resonate in Fallujah and Najaf and Washington? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Austin, with a great symphony behind us all, from Austin, Texas, is Tom Palaima, professor of classics at the University of Texas. His op-ed, The Difference Between Hollywood's Troy and Homer's, appeared in Tuesday's Austin American State newspaper. And last fall, he taught three classes on the Iliad and the experience of war at West Point. Good evening and welcome, Tom Palaima.
Oh, hi. How are you doing?
Wonderful. Thanks very much for being with us. And with us from Santa Fe, New Mexico, is Barry Goldfarb, tutor, that's what they call professors, at St. John's College of Great Books fame. He's a classicist and delivered a lecture this year entitled, What Does the Iliad Really Mean? Good evening and welcome, Barry Goldfarb.
Good evening.
Thanks very much for joining us. Thanks to you both. So we're going to have plenty of sound from the movie tonight, but it's really the epic behind the movie that you both know so well that we wanted to dip into tonight. I guess I'll ask you first, Tom Palaima, first to you. Have you seen the movie? Can you see the Iliad that you know in it?
No, there's very little of the Iliad that we know in the movie. I saw it last Sunday night and was really very surprised by how little resemblance it bears to the Iliad of Homer. And that's not just in the changing around of factual mm-hmm. details, mm-hmm. But it's in the effectively gutting of all of the great moral and ethical questions that the Iliad raises.
Well, we're going to pull those out tonight. But, Barry Goldfarb, to you, have you seen it? And did you see the Iliad on the screen?
I saw it last night, and I'm afraid I have to agree with Tom on this. It was not only that it restructures so much and changes a lot of the plot line, but it misses so many of the major questions, which seems to me that the epic itself raises.
Well, we're not going to miss those tonight. It might be great, given the way you describe it, for people who've seen the movie and not read the book, or haven't read the book in a long time, Tom Palaima, would you be good enough to give us the Iliad in a nutshell? First, the narrative line, and then we'll get to the big questions, the big moral issues.
Well, one of the amusing things that came up after the film was out there was one of the reviews that was quoted said that this film put the focus on Achilles, which it wasn't in the original. Of course, the focus in the original is on Achilles, mm-hmm. and it is also in the movie, but it's the nature of that focus. In Homer's Iliad, the whole thing starts out by saying, Menene eidetea peleado Achilleos, I sing the wrath or rage of Achilles.
Right.
In children's novels, there are these Brian Jacques children's novels. This would be called The Blood Wrath. I just finished reading one of these books with my child. Mm. And the wrath of Achilles in this instance is raised because he's been fighting 10 long years at Troy. The movie, I think, gives us 15 days at Troy.
Mm-hmm.
But 10 long years at Troy, he's been the most stalwart and principled of the warriors. In book 9, he even says, "I fought 11 engagements by land, and, or 12 by land and 11 by sea. I sacked cities in order to support the troops in the war effort." And in the 10th year of the war, when great disaffection is arising among the troops, Agamemnon does something to publicly disgrace Achilles, and this is what causes the rift between Achilles and Agamemnon. Achilles says, "I will fight no more," and withdraws himself and his Myrmidon troops.
Right.
It's at that point, then, that the narrative sweep of the Iliad takes hold, and we get a series of major battle sequences. These are what the ancient Greeks called aristeai, or displays of excellence, of warrior excellence, mm-hmm. by various heroes.
Mm-hmm.
In book 6, we get an inside view of what it's like to be on the receiving end of a great siege. We get the powerful scenes between Hector and Andromache, his wife,
mm-hmm.
and we even have a battlefield confrontation between Glaucus and Diomedes, where enemies recognize their common humanity across the battle lines.
I want to come to those. Barry Goldfarb, first, if you would, for us, the cause of this great battle in the Iliad and in Troy, the movie, they essentially boil down to the same, at least, cause for war, that Helen has been taken off to Troy and away from the Greek king.
That's true, but as Tom was pointing out, the Iliad starts with that already having happened, and there are allusions to it, but only allusions. The epic itself doesn't really ever deal with the cause and the rightness or the wrongness of Helen's going off with Paris. That's all in the background. That's history. In fact, the old men of Troy at one point are looking at her and they say, I'm not sure it's worth it, but she's awfully beautiful.
Right. That's right. That's in book 3. It's just a wonderful scene. And as Barry is pointing out, what the Iliad does, you see, is concentrate and focus our attentions on the costs and the realities of war, from both sides, both from the point of view of the warriors in the field. That's
mm-hmm.
why West Point was interested in hearing talks on this subject, and also from the point of view of what is the cost to the citizens as a whole. I mean, in your introduction, you were talking about what lessons might the Iliad hold for us now as we're in Iraq, and how could it translate perhaps to our situation in Fallujah?
Mm-hmm.
And there are many, many, I think Barry will agree with me on this, you can start cataloging the ways in which the Iliad would speak to that issue if the Iliad were put on film.
Oh, well, get us started. We can see any film we want in our mind's eye tonight. Get us started on that list of lessons that you'd bring to today.
Well, one of my major, the critical concern that I have, my editorial in The Statesman was picked up on the History News Network and also in classic websites. So,
and this is where you say that the Iliad taught Greeks, young and old, what they needed to know about war.
Exactly. You have to go back to a period. First off, the estimates for the amount of time when the Greek city-states were at war, this again is a farcical aspect of the Iliad, Barry will agree with me, we start out with Agamemnon having a United States of Greece. The Greeks never achieved that until Alexander the Great came in.
Oh, you mean in the movie? This is
Agamemnon's. In the movie. So,
right.
I mean, so there's a crazy thing. But one of my major concerns is that throughout the 20th century, and this is what fueled the animosity of warriors who come back from the field. If you can start in World War I with Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon, E.E. Mm-hmm. Cummings even mm-hmm. speaks to this, Hemingway speaks to this.
Disillusioned warriors.
Warriors who come back and say, the home front has no idea of what we were experiencing out there. None at all. And this carries right on through up into the, you know, the 21st century. And if you've read any accounts of embedded journalism or pooling journalism from Gulf War I and to now Operation Iraqi Freedom, the information from the front is controlled. Now, the Greeks had warfare as a constant, and therefore they understood that their main enculturating myth, this is what the Iliad is. Mm-hmm. You had no schools until the 4th century. And so the way the Greeks learned about life, learned about how to be citizens, was by hearing these great myths told. And what the Iliad encapsulated for them was all aspects of this. And so it's not in any way this is why I stress again and again in my editorial, these things are real to the Greeks. There are real consequences when a commander alienates his troops. Mm-hmm. There are real consequences when soldiers become attached to one another and go out to fight in the battlefield.
Consequences of a sort that we can still see playing out
every
day today. Let's listen to just a little bit of how the movie depicts. And here's a scene. I guess they're on a boat headed from Greece back to Troy, which is, of course, in what we would call Turkey today. And here it depicts brothers, Paris and Hector, princes of Troy. They've got Helen on their ship. They're dragging her off to Troy. And Hector, played by Eric Bana, says to Paris, played by Orlando Bloom, "You know nothing of love and death."
Do you know how many years our father worked for peace?
I love her.
And you think you know something about love? What about your father's love? You spat on him when you brought her on this ship. What about the love for your country? You'd let Troy burn for this woman?
I won't let you start a war for her.
May I speak? What you say is true. I've wronged you. I've wronged our father. If you want to take Helen back to Sparta, so be it. But I go with her. To Sparta, they'll kill you. Then I'll die fighting. Oh, and that sounds heroic to you, doesn't it? To die fighting. Tell me, little brother, have you ever killed a man?
No.
Ever seen a man die in combat?
No.
I've killed men. And I've heard them dying. And I've watched them dying, and there's nothing glorious about it. Nothing poetic. You say you want to die for love, but you know nothing about dying, and you know nothing about love.
Hector and Paris at sea with Helen, soon to be of Troy, in Hollywood's Troy. Barry Goldfarb, all that prelude, as you've pointed out, to the Iliad, and yet here's this talk. You know nothing of war. I know of war. As if, listen up, you'll learn. And also of interest, of what takes these armies and these kings to war. What about interests in the Iliad? How is that described?
Well, the thing that puzzled me, that I was most intrigued about with the film, is the emphasis on love as a motivating force, and the notion that one doesn't earn honor in warfare, which the Greeks, and I think Tom was sort of pointing in this direction, for the Greeks, warfare was a condition that was the norm, and one could earn warfare. There was at a high cost.
Could earn honor.
Honor.
And of course, the movie's all about that, but it's in the realm of Achilles primarily.
Well, see, I'm not...
His mother says to him, played by Julie Christie, you can become immortal. Your name will be known forever if you go to this war, but it will cost you.
That seems to be an underlying theme of the entire the book itself. Now, what the movie seemed to trivialize that, it seemed to me, that the moral question that I find underlying the Iliad, which is why I love it so much, is that Achilles is in a society where warfare is the norm, and the real question is what it means to be excellent. He's
exactly
called the best of the Achaeans. And so being the best of the Achaeans, and as Tom has pointed out, Agamemnon has insulted him in front of everybody needlessly. Mm. But that question of excellence and how it unfolds with the death of Patroclus, which the movie has sort of transformed. And so the cost of that excellence in this endeavor of warfare turns out to be extraordinarily high for Achilles.
Of course, in the movie, Achilles comes to a tough end, as do a lot of people as well. We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking about human nature and war in Homer's Iliad and Hollywood's Troy, maybe in America's Iraq you can join the conversation. Have you seen Troy? Have you reread the Iliad? Have you read it for the first time? What's the message on war and its consequences for the world today? Are arrogance and hidden interests always at work in war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about war and human nature in Homer's The Iliad and Hollywood's Troy, maybe in America's Iraq. My guest tonight, Thomas Palaima. Joining us from Austin, Texas, professor of classics at the University of Texas, and from Santa Fe, New Mexico, Barry Goldfarb, tutor in the Great Books program at St. John's College, teaches Greek there and humanities. You can join us tonight as well. What lessons from the Iliad and Troy resonate today in Baghdad and Washington? What's here for us to learn about heroism, honor, the price of each? What is won and lost at the walls of Troy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's hear just another bit from the film. Here we have a kind of 11th hour negotiation when the armies are assembled. The Trojan prince Hector, played by Eric Bana, urges the Greek king Agamemnon in Troy, in the film, played by Brian Cox, to withdraw his armies, vowing never to be ruled by foreigners.
You come here uninvited. Go back to your ships and go home.
Look around you, Hector. I brought all the warriors of Greece to your shores.
You can still save Troy, young prince.
I have two wishes. If you grant them, no more of your people need die. First, you must give Helen back to my brother. Second, Troy must submit to my command to fight for me whenever I call.
You want me to look upon your army and tremble? Well, I see them. I see 50,000 men brought here to fight for one man's greed.
Careful, boy. My mercy has limits.
And I've seen the limits of your mercy. And I tell you now, no son of Troy will ever submit to a foreign ruler.
Then every son of Troy shall die.
Shall die. Lots of talk of foreign rulers there that might resonate today. In the movie Troy, Hector and King Agamemnon, before the gates of Troy, was surrounded by great armies. Thomas Palaima, what do you hear in this Troy interpretation of the Iliad and the underlying lessons, if you can trace them back to the classical work?
Well, let me go back to the question we were talking about just before the break, because mm-hmm. It's very pertinent here. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about are the things that motivate human beings to fight wars. Mm-hmm. And certainly in the ancient Greek, I mean, I was really struck by the fact that David Denby in his New Yorker review of the film could speak about Achilles as a glory freak, quote unquote. And the word glory is certainly one way of translating what Barry was talking about before. What the Greek warriors strive for is timē. But this is what the best definition would be: publicly exhibited honor. That is the honor mm-hmm. that's awarded you in public for your service. It's the actual root of the word comes from the Indo-European root for payment. It's what you're paid.
That acclaim, honor and acclaim.
Yeah, honor and acclaim, but it's a payment for the virtuous acts you're doing for the state mm-hmm. in war. Mm-hmm. So this whole idea that the film, if you'll remember, starts out with Agamemnon up north trying to compel the king of Thessaly to come along with him, to fall under his rule.
Join the tide of my conquest.
Yes, indeed. And then there's this kind of David and Goliath scene where the Thessalians have this champion who's about 9 foot tall. And then where is Achilles? He's in a menage a trois in his hut. And he comes out and then does a kind of flying spider leap. I have a graduate student at this large guy and knifes him in the neck.
This is Brad Pitt, of course, in leather skirt, straight out of his.
That's right. From the very first scene, what is there is a kind of I don't know what it is. In fact, it's a kind of, I don't know, a capitalist ideal run amok.
What do you mean by that? A capitalist ideal run amok?
Well, I mean, there's a total gutting of any sense of obligation to the state.
Presented as a complete lone wolf here.
Yeah, he's a lone wolf, somebody who's interested effectively in drugs aren't in there, but in sex and warfare, rock and roll.
But also in honor, he says repeatedly he wants his name to live forever.
That's right, because you know the ancient Greeks. I mean, and perhaps this is one place where they maybe Barry has a different take on this, but they may get it right. The ancient Greeks have no afterlife to speak of at this period. When Odysseus comes across Achilles in the underworld, he says, yes, but you're effectively king of the underworld. Isn't that a grand thing? And he says, I would rather be a slave of a sharecropper on the face of the earth than be king of the underworld. So there's a miserable afterlife. What a person can attain that will live on is name for the achievements in war. But those achievements in war I don't even know how to describe how it's represented in the film. Maybe Barry can come up with a better way. But it's all very self-serving, if you understand what
it is. Yes, clearly.
And very different from how Homer does it. One of the things that's striking about the battle scenes in Homer is that there are often, for when someone is killed, there's a brief description of who his parents were.
Right.
It's something where he's from.
Right.
There might be a little vignette. There's one guy who has just gotten married and hasn't yet slept with his wife. Another. Often they're compared to the natural world. In fact, when Patroclus is killed.
This is
armor.
Presented in the movie as the cousin of Achilles. In the Iliad, I'm not sure if he's cousin, but there's kind of a homoerotic connection.
There's certainly
connection.
A homoerotic, though there are women involved also.
Mm-hmm.
So sexuality was not the same thing for them as it
mm-hmm.
is for us.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, when he's killed and his armor is taken, it's Achilles' armor that's taken, and Achilles then is lacking armor.
Because
so
Patroclus has gone off to fight in his armor. Confused.
Can I just interrupt
yes,
a second? You know, in the movie, in the film, Patroclus does this on the sly. And in Homer,
mm-hmm.
Patroclus approaches Achilles and says, well, if you're not going to fight, let me fight with you. And so Achilles knows about it, is complicitous in it, and in fact is sending essentially his other self out there. And it's all part of an intricate design. And so when later Achilles goes into the field to face Hector, Hector is wearing Achilles' armor. And Achilles is essentially...
Because it's been taken off of the dead Patroclus in the earlier fight.
And Achilles then is effectively fighting himself on the battlefield.
Well, there's no question that Homer, in all of his glory, is going to have more nuance than Troy on the screen. But let's get a sense of how a movie person looks at this movie for a second. We're joined right now from Middletown, Connecticut, by Janine Basinger. She's chair of the Film Studies Department at Wesleyan University, author of many books on film, including American Cinema, 100 Years of Filmmaking. Janine Basinger, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome.
So here we have the classicists and, you
never
know...
Never the twain shall meet.
Right. I mean, you can hear, in a sense, of course, the pleasure that the story is being put up on the screen, but then a million points at which it's not lining up happily with what they'd like to see conveyed.
Oh, I know. I love hearing what they were saying. I just was so interested in it, and I was thinking... It's not a surprise to me that Wolfgang Petersen is no Homer.
wash your mind of all that for just a moment. And as a moviegoer and critic and lover, what did you take away from this film?
Well, first of all, a movie person does what a classicist does in the sense that they compare it to the real thing. I compare it to other movies of its ilk or other versions of this story. And I take it as a movie, is it a good movie? I mean, because obviously I'm not an expert on Homer.
Mm-hmm.
As a movie of its type, I would say it's really better than average. And I don't mean to say that it's would be satisfying to Homer experts or that it's a good version of the Iliad or anything.
But as a movie, better than average, why?
It's better than average because, first of all, it does have excellent pacing. It has what usually goes wrong for movies of this type is they're extremely turgid, and as they go forward, they get slower and slower.
Wallowing
and slower.
Along, yeah.
This has quite good rhythm and pacing. It's very well edited. It has beautiful costuming. I'm sure weird costuming, but very interesting, quite beautifully done. And it tells a ripping good story. After all, and I think we can all agree on this, it is a great story, even if they don't tell it well or correctly or whatever. And it is, I think, a better than average example of epic filmmaking.
In kind of an old style, in a way. It took me back to Ben-Hur.
Definitely.
Not so splashy and flashy.
Definitely. And, you know, it's interesting to hear the dialogue on the radio because I was thinking, gee, I didn't remember it being that bad. But because when it's in the context of the huge screen and the characters.
And speaking, very dramatic visual.
Absolutely. It seems, you know, to be a different thing.
And I would like to say that's a very good point because, I mean, I was actually shocked that there was even some substantive dialogue. I mean, I sat through the film and I said, oh, boy, I didn't remember those exchanges.
Well, it's better. It's really better than most epic films. I mean, in that regard, you know, usually in an epic, you come to that moment when someone is saying something like, oh, Moses, you adorable fool, you know, and it kind of avoids that until it gets sort of to here in the Escomica City. But, I mean, I went expecting nothing. You have no idea how my feet drag at any kind of epic. And hearing that we're going to have one called Troy, I'm like, oh, and it's got Brad Pitt. Could someone please give me a break? I'm
Forget
too
about
old.
It, but it turned out better than that for
and
you.
It was entertaining. Yeah, I found it entertaining.
Dear movie maven and classicist, if you'll let me, I want to invite our callers in. A lot of them are waiting to join the conversation. Calvin is calling from Flatville, Wisconsin. Hi, Calvin. You're on the air.
Yes, sir.
Good evening.
You asked what someone might have learned from the movie, and I haven't seen it, but I just recently returned from Iraq, and one of the things that struck me is in the little soundbite that you gave where Achilles is speaking to his king, who is all conceited about having won the war, and Achilles basically tells him that, if I got it correct, basically tells him that he's not a soldier, he has no clue what's going on.
And don't be so sure you've won the war yet, by the way.
Right. I think our politicians, and even seeing over there some of the higher generals, could learn that lesson, because I know talking to some of the Vietnam veterans, and from what I saw in Iraq and even when I was in Bosnia, is the politicians need to learn. Let the war be run by the soldiers and the people on the ground rather than trying to, you know, you can make policy, but don't try and run specifics from back in Washington.
Calvin, what were you doing in Iraq?
I was with the 229th Engineer Company near Tikrit.
And were you and your fellow soldiers there talking about distant kings or powers running things the wrong way?
We had a lot of discussions looking at, for instance, another unit from Wisconsin, the 32nd MP Company, has been extended for another 4 months beyond their 1 year in Iraq. Well, they've already been put on schedule for another rotation to Iraq. So as it looks like a lot of the leadership goes for an easy fix when they need people, they lose the long-term view of, okay, if I keep these people another 4 months, then what happens is we try and get them back into the rotation later, just as one example.
Calvin, we've got it, and we thank you for your unique perspective just back from Iraq. Barry Goldfarb, here's one message that I don't know what you thought of the speech as Brad Pitt delivered it, but is very likely to resonate with American soldiers coming back from tough duty and prolonged duty in Iraq saying, hey, you know, kings/presidents don't fight these wars. We fight them.
I had a problem, and this is why I'd be interested in hearing Janine's perspective on this. My problem was I didn't really care about the Achilles figure terribly much.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't seem as sympathetic as the character in the book. And therefore, all of his rant, I think that there was a lot to what he was saying, but for some reason, the horrors of power, which seemed to be manifested in Menelaus and Agamemnon, they were almost
the Greek kings.
Mm-hmm. The Greek kings, but they were also the characters playing them were not attractive characters.
Well, let me also say, in the Iliad, when you first see Achilles, he is coming forward to champion the cause of the rest of the troops.
Mm-hmm.
Agamemnon has brought a plague by dishonoring a priest of Apollo, and everybody knows this, and he's not willing to fess up to it. And so the pack pack animals, the men are dying, and it's Achilles who comes forward and tries to settle the situation.
Out of the ranks of the warriors.
Yes, and also, and so he's acting for the, so he's a very sympathetic character from the start, and you get the sense that Agamemnon has dishonored him. And as I said in the film, I mean, when the first scene you see is of Brad Pitt not being on duty when he should be, and instead in his tent with two beautiful women in a menage a trois, I mean, it just gives you a total different beginning attitude towards the character.
Jenny Basinger, of course, there's Brad Pitt, famous Hollywood eye candy, you know, and looking fine here, but I found the real sympathetic hero that came out of the movie
Hector.
Was Hector, of
yeah,
course.
Of course. Yeah. Hector rises in stature over the, I would agree that the Achilles is a little bit pouty here and not present, his motivations are, it isn't as clear, it isn't as heroic, or, and the opening way he is presented, that is an absolutely, that's what we in film would call a very good script note. You set the character the way you first see him, and the fact is he is not noble, and that is an extremely important point. I thought the movie told us that war is a bum deal, fought for selfish reasons, often manipulated by greedy men who don't themselves take the risks and who aren't out there. And one of the great makers of war movies in film history is Sam Fuller, a man who fought the big war and the big red one all the way through Omaha Beach, etc. And he said the only way to show an audience war is to bring them in, set them in their seats, and start shooting at them. There is no way to depict it the way it is. So other than that, the images that you put are what the modern poet has to share. And that's I've always found that interesting, because as we have been able to see so many images of war on the TV screen, on the movie screen, and documentaries, yep. It shifts our – it does harden us in a way. It detaches us. And that's, of course, what makes the words of Homer so important at a time when that wasn't cheap and easy.
Tom Palaima, what about that takeaway of Janine's war as a bum deal made by kings for selfish reasons? Would Homer endorse that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, I mean, certainly that's what's going on with the Agamemnon character. And I also think it was right to stress the value of Hector, both in the film and in the Iliad. And in fact, there's a famous anthropologist slash classicist named James Redfield who argues that the Iliad is the tragedy of Hector rather than the tragedy of Achilles. Of course, it's both in many ways. But again, this is all part of the experience of warfare. You could not, in the 5th century Athens, when you have, in a let's say, an 80-year period, you have the city-state of Athens being at war for maybe 60 of those years, sending men out into the field to do brutal warfare. In 415, they literally destroy the island of Melos and put all the men to death. And when you put men to death in that period, you were using swords and spears. It's close-up death. It's not high-altitude bombing. You could not tell these people who had been out in the field when commanders had screwed up, when things did not go right, when the citizens decided to send you on a mission that had no purpose and would achieve nothing. You could not sell them a vision of war that said, oh, your commander-in-chief is always going to have pure motives. You're always going to be fighting for truth, justice, and the American way. They had to be shown war as it was. And so all of that is there.
Because Hector, they knew what it was. Tom Palaima, Barry Goldfarb, Janine Basinger, please stand by. We're going to take a short break. We're talking about war and human nature in Homer's Iliad and Hollywood's Troy. What's won and what's lost at the walls of Troy in the depths of war? And what can, what should we learn from the Iliad? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about war and human nature in Homer's Iliad, in Hollywood's Troy, maybe in America's Iraq. Here is Hector from the film Troy, played by Eric Bana, Hector, Prince of Troy, giving his code of honor to rally the soldiers of Troy.
All my life, I've lived by a code, and the code is simple. Honor the gods, love your woman, and defend your country. Troy is mother to us all. Fight for her!
My Gods, My Woman, My Country. I'm joined tonight by Thomas Palaima, professor of classics at the University of Texas, Barry Goldfarb, tutor in the Great Books Program at St. John's College, and Janine Basinger, chair of the Film Studies Department at Wesleyan University. Barry Goldfarb, what about that code as representative or not of what Homer suggests in the mouths of the admirable in war in the ancient Greek days as the code of honor?
The code of honor is extraordinarily important. And I think Hector has captured it in that passage, that section you just played. The scene in the Iliad, he's actually talking to his wife, and he seems to know that he's going to die if he goes out there. It's all those overtones of his impending death. And so it's in the Iliad, it's the recognition that he has to fulfill this code to be the person he wants to be.
And is this the code that Homer would have in his mouth?
He would have the essence of it, but it wouldn't be the jingoistic version.
But God's My Woman, My Country?
It would be more for honor, that this teammate that Tom was talking about before. Mm-hmm. One has to do, to be a full human being, to be flourishing in a full person, one has to stand up for these things, even if there are worse things in the Greek code than death itself. Dishonor is much worse than dying. And so that's part of the problem the filmmakers had in trying to convert this to a modern blockbuster. Mm-hmm. So his code would have been, I don't care about death. If it's my time to die, I'll die. The gods will decide that. But during my life, I have to live it not really for woman, country, and
gods,
but for all of for that's what it means to be a human being in the cosmos. So the tragedy of the Iliad, it seems to me, I'm not convinced that the Iliad is actually a war book itself. War is the backdrop for the attempt to be a full human being, and what that means in this context is to be a great killer.
Tom Palaima, if I may, when you went to West Point to talk about the Iliad, what did you want them to hear? What did you want them to learn? What did they want to know?
Well, I would have to say, first off, that I have a former student there, Lieutenant Colonel Ted Westhoving, who's an academy professor. And there's a great concern there with, A, ethics, and B, how you create the proper mentality and psychological composition for people you're going to send into the field. And Barry was hitting the point very well in the Iliad, namely the soldiers we sent out. We had the one caller who's back in Wisconsin now. Back from Iraq. The soldiers we send off in the field are our fellow citizens. They are human beings. And what the movie does, and I'm quoting here Peterson from Der Spiegel, the German
director. Yeah.
He says, for those of you who don't know mythology, you know, Hector and Achilles are Batman versus Superman, and that's totally taking things out of context. What the Iliad, Barry was absolutely right. The Iliad is about life, and it's about people who, men, women, children, who are all affected by warfare, because warfare is a constant in life. The other thing about this jingoistic aspect, again, that was a very good word for Barry to use, we get rah-rah-rah jingoism. Hector in the event is scared shitless of Achilles, and he runs. He fears for his life. Priam comes out and says, don't face this killer. Come inside. And you know what?
Priam, the king of Troy, his father.
Yes. And I often say to my classes, can you imagine the outrage if President Bush had two sons who could be sent to Iraq, and he came out and publicly said, don't go. Come back in. I'll save you. I'll use my pole to save you. But the Iliad shows this because that's how a father should react. Every father should want his son to live.
With that kind of honesty, and here's a king, of course, talking to a prince,
yeah,
a prince
it's,
that
it's,
he
it's,
needs
it's,
to succeed
it's amazing,
him.
And it's right there for you. It's right there for you to see.
Janine Basinger, do you see in this an anti-war film or a film that's jaundiced about heroism and war, or one that celebrates ultimately some, even if very individualistic, glory?
Every movie is about war is, if you're a human being watching it, an anti-war film. Because it can't be anything else if you have any kind of human sensitivity. Some movies come down on the side of let's go get them, and others come down on the side of this isn't the right thing to be doing. But they always like to have it both ways. Unfortunately, they want to sell tickets. The most pacifist war film always contains great battle scenes that are exciting, and the most exciting pro-war battle movie always has scenes of sadness and death that make you know it's not a good deal. That's the brilliance of the filmmaking business. Have it both ways and get everybody's dollar. But this film, I think, finally is telling us pretty much war is not good. I think that's the side it's coming down on, but it's not coming down too clear in a too clear-minded a way. But it is saying, no, you are at the mercy of bad men who are often doing it for greedy reasons. But if you have to do it, you do it in a noble manner, honoring your country, your family, whatever. So it is also in its own way having it both ways, which doesn't really have anything to do with the Iliad. I mean, it's really the film in itself is facing an audience where it may have a divided audience. Mm-hmm. So it is coming cleverly down a middle line.
A film that no doubt previewed by test audiences.
You bet.
In at least with a technology that Homer could never be. Gee, we're out of time. There's so much more I'd like to hear you talk about on this one, but perhaps another time. Jeanine Basinger, thank you so much for joining
us
tonight.
You're welcome, and I really enjoyed hearing the two scholars. You guys were great.
Me too.
Well, likewise.
Jeanine, thanks for being with
us.
Jeanine Basinger, Chair of Film Studies Department at Wesleyan University. Barry Goldfarb, Santa Fe, New Mexico at St. John's College. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Tom Palaima at the University of Texas, Professor of Classics in Austin, Texas. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Hey, thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. Coming up, Jack Beatty joins me for a look back at the week's news. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
How can you explain the culture of abuse that was allowed to develop in a prison system under your ultimate command?
I don't believe that the culture of abuse existed in my command.
The military judge found Specialist Civitz guilty of the charges in accordance with his pleas and sentenced him to reduction to Private E1, a bad conduct discharge, and 1 year of confinement.
A few days after the president of the governing council was blown up by terrorist action at an American checkpoint, and the Ministry of Interior has nothing else to do, ransack my office and vandalize my belongings.
It is a tragic incident. I believe the activities of the Israeli Defense Forces in Gaza in recent days have caused a problem and have worsened the situation.
On the one hand, they decry the price at the pump, and on the other hand, they won't do anything about it. They won't take action. Congress needs to pass the energy plan.
The president thinks Alan Greenspan is doing a great job, and that's why he believes he should be renominated. Obviously, there are term limits on the position, but the president wants him to continue to serve as long as possible.
I've always had enormous respect for Ralph Nader. I've known him for 30 years. I admired his battle on automobile safety and other things that he's done. I've worked with him as a senator. So I think he's done a lot of good.
By the power vested in me by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, I now pronounce you fully and legally married.
And there's a week, Senator Robert Byrd put the commander of U.S. Central Command, General John Abizaid, on the hot seat over the Abu Ghraib prisoner abuse scandal in a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing. Specialist Jeremy Sivitz becomes the first U.S. soldier convicted of abusing Iraqi prisoners. He will spend 1 year in jail. The home of one-time Pentagon favorite Ahmad Chalabi is raided by Iraqi police backed by U.S. forces. Israeli action to root out militants and weapons smugglers leads to more than 40 Palestinians dead in Gaza, and criticism from U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell. Gasoline prices hit record highs across the country. President Bush blames Congress for not passing his energy bill. Alan Greenspan is nominated to a fifth term as chairman of the Federal Reserve. Presumptive Democratic nominee John Kerry meets and makes nice with presidential rival Ralph Nader, and the country's first fully sanctioned legal gay marriages are performed in Massachusetts. Of course, Jack, the president will go on television Monday night to talk about his forward-looking view of what's going to happen with the handover June 30th in Iraq, but plenty of trouble this week in Iraq probably prompts him to come forward on Monday.
Yes, I mean, we've had, of course, the scandal surrounding everything, but right at the center of it, the biggest scandal of all, Mr. Chalabi. Who, of course, was the darling of the Pentagon, who gave him something like $27 million to taxpayers in recent years. He gave wrong and probably deliberately misleading intelligence on the weapons of mass destruction.
The best-loved Iraqi exile.
Yes, sat with Mrs. Bush, behind Mrs. Bush at the State of the Union.
Yep.
Do you suppose if President Bush had that question that he couldn't answer again?
About the mistake?
Have you ever made a mistake? Do you think he would say, well, yes, we did. We believed this charlatan and embezzler that there were these weapons, and we basically now have committed hundreds of lives and hundreds of millions of dollars following his footsteps.
Billions.
And now we're discovering, of course, that he's a crook. Not only that, he's had to do with Iranian intelligence. Isn't this something?
But raiding and ransacking, is this the way one-time friends work out their issues? I mean, something's gone incredibly wrong here.
Well, he must have been very close to the quick there with the Iranians, is what I suspect, and that really he was endangering. I think if the issue is running guns to the Shiite opposition, he was endangering American lives. But you know, I mean, his friends are still circling the wagon. There are just few of them. But over the Pentagon, there really should be a sign that has Auden's line from his great poem, 1939. The sign should say, "Intellectual disgrace stares from every human face."
A change in the weather, you'd have to say, though, Jack, around Iraq, the administration has asked for $25 billion more, and it is not just sailing through this time.
It's not. The Congress is asking for accountability. They want to know. They actually want to know what you're going to do with the money. And, of course, the past appropriations were all these sort of symbolic hopes and prayers. Well, okay, well, you'll do the right thing with it. Well, we know, of course, according to quote Bill Kristol, they have done the incompetent thing with it in running this war. And, you know, that is one of the things that's happening. More and more conservatives and even neoconservatives are throwing up their hands in disgust at the inept conduct of what they thought was a noble and promising adventure. Of course, they were being gulled by Mr. Chalabi.
Including Republicans in the U.S. Senate.
They are indeed. And we've had some brave Republicans this week. John Warner, chairman of the Armed Services Committee in the Senate, despite criticism from his own party, went ahead with his hearings. And Duncan Hunter, the chairman of the House, said, oh, well, you're calling back those generals from Iraq. They should be fighting the war. And Mr. Warner said, no, they were going to be here anyway. And four Republican senators, Collins, Snow, Chafee, and McCain, have basically held up the Bush budget and said, nope, we're not voting for this unless we begin to pay for these tax cuts ourselves. We're not going to just charge it all to the kids.
A lot of American minds beginning to really get focused here. We'll have the president Monday night on this show, and hope you'll be with us, Jack. I'm sure you will. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.